Remember those $4.5 billion Congress passed to improve border detention facilities?
The American taxpayer shouldn't be spending $4.5 billion without actually improving the condition down there.
Today on The World, Congresswoman Judy Chu. She's just back from a tour of two Border Patrol facilities in Texas, and she did not like what she saw. Also today, a social media trend in Indonesia where young people skip dating and go straight to marriage. It's made one couple crazy famous.
Their Instagram accounts, 2 million followers combined, they're just videos of their excruciating cuteness set to cheesy music.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency will investigate a Facebook group, a group where current and former CBP agents shared racist jokes and offensive insults against migrants and members of Congress. Border Patrol Chief Carla Provost issued a statement saying any employees found to have violated our standards of conduct will be held accountable. The Facebook group was exposed yesterday just as a congressional delegation was visiting a Border Patrol station in El Paso and a migrant detention center in Clint, Texas. Clint was the site that gained notoriety last month when attorneys described squalid conditions there and mistreatment of children. It seems both facilities still have problems.
What we saw was appalling and disgusting.
Representative Judy Chu, a California Democrat, was part of the congressional delegation that visited both sites.
In the El Paso Border Patrol station, we saw women in their cells, and as soon as they realized we were Congress members, they told us their stories with tears coming down their faces. They talked about being separated from their children. They talked about not knowing when they were going to leave, and most had been there for over 50 days. Some of them had talked about not getting the medications that they needed. One was an epileptic and still had not gotten her medication. They talked about not having running water. And in fact, one said that a CBP agent had told her to drink water out of a toilet in order to get her water.
Was she the only person you spoke to who gave that account?
She actually told Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez about this. So she was the only one that talked about being told this by the CBP officer, but others talked about not having running water.
What is the usual time limit in a center like this? And what kind of center is this? What is it actually supposed to be doing?
This is the transitional station in which migrants are first processed. And for children, there's a limit of 72 hours, but there is not supposed to be this long period of time for anybody. So to think that these women are in their cells for over 50 days is just appalling. And of course, they have terrible conditions. In fact, they said that they were in these little tent cities within El Paso. And for the day, they were brought into these cells, which were air conditioned. And so there was clearly an attempt to sanitize the situation, which we also saw at the Clint Border Patrol station.
Yeah, what stood out for you in Clint, Texas yesterday?
What stood out for me is that they clearly tried to sanitize it. I was shocked because we'd heard reports of the number of children there being at a high of 700. When we got there, there was a magically low number of 25. Which led us to ask, well, why did you say that there was a crisis of people coming over the border? And they took great pains to show us all their tremendous supplies, the toothbrushes, soap, and food. But we were able to see the warehouse where over 100 children were housed. It was like a gigantic steel shed with no air conditioning at the time. And in this location, temperatures frequently get to over 100 degrees. And the most disturbing thing is they denied all the reports of the lawyers that had come in previous weeks of the reports of children being in their clothes, not having to be able to clean for nearly a month, clothes caked with snot and tears, toddlers without diapers relieving themselves in their pants. They denied all of that.
And you didn't see any evidence of that yourself?
They did not, because basically they cleared out the children. We saw toddlers pressing their little faces against the cells And that was about it. But we did not see the children out in the play area because they had drastically reduced the amount of people there.
Where did they go?
I do not know. But we could see.
Did you ask?
Yes, we did ask. And they said, oh, there are fewer children coming over the border.
Representative Chu, what was your interaction like with the CBP agents? What did you think of their conduct?
That was also appalling. Of course, the supervisors treated us very officially. But that morning, we had gotten notice of the ProPublica article about the Facebook page of the CBP agents. Can you imagine?
A Facebook page where members of the group had posted offensive jokes and vulgar insults about migrants and insults about some of your colleagues you were with yesterday.
Well, we were right there when we got notice of the ProPublica article. We were all there together reading this article and seeing these disgusting images and reading about their jokes about the death of migrants, including that father and daughter. It was such a moving image, and they were laughing at it. They also talked about wanting to throw burritos at us as we were investigating at the stations. So just to see this underground group of agents out of control doing and saying what they like, that was of huge concern to us. And we even felt concerned about our safety. You know, I know they have a tough job and there's a lot of stress there. But to see how blatantly they disregard Congress members, can you imagine what they are doing to migrants that are totally under their control?
The CBP came out with a statement very much distancing themselves from this Facebook group. Can U.S. Congress people request CBP to discipline anybody who's involved with this?
That's what we're calling for. We are calling for accountability for the organizers of this Facebook page. It is not right, and they need to be held accountable for this.
So you're following up with this request for some kind of sanction on these CBP agents. How else are you following up? What are you planning to do to address what you saw yesterday down in Texas?
Well, clearly, what we had proposed for the border supplemental bill that was passed last week was needed. These provisions in the House bill included standards for medical care and medical emergencies, nutrition, hygiene and facilities, and personal training for CBP agents. And that was left out of this Senate bill that was passed, including accountability for the funds so that the designated purposes were the only purposes for which the money could be used and not for deportation and enforcement purposes. Also, I think the most critical thing was that there should have been the ability for us to have unannounced visits, because it is clear that CBP sanitizes the situation before we come. That was in the bill, and it wasn't in the final passage of the bill. This is what we have to go back and continue to push for.
Yeah, there are some Democratic lawmakers who say the bill did not go far enough, and that's why they voted against it. Did you vote for or against it?
Oh, I definitely voted against it.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you feel that in order to kind of push your view on immigration, that maybe you're cheating some of these people down along the border who actually need that money right now?
I was for the House version of the bill, which had actually all the money in it, but it had accountability for how the money is spent. The American taxpayer shouldn't be spending $4.5 billion without accountability, without actually improving the condition down there. And that is what needs to be done. So that's why I could not vote for this bill, not in good conscience.
Democrat Judy Chu, representative from California, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
When it comes to Iran, President Trump has made it clear he wants Tehran's oil exports to come down to zero. The U.S. has gone as far as to say that any country or company that imports Iranian oil will face penalties. There are ways to get around those restrictions, like tanker ships that turn off their automated tracking devices when they pick up oil from Iranian ports. That's precisely what the firm Tanker Tracker says is happening. Amir Paivar reported on Iran's oil and gas industry for years. He's now an independent analyst in London.
In international shipping, ships have a system by which you can see where they are in the world. It's called Automated Identification System, or AIS. Now, there are expert groups like tanker trackers, for example, who follow these tankers, oil tankers, and see them all of a sudden disappearing from the map. But they also have access to commercial satellite technology using which you can actually see these tankers in international waters. If you have enough time to kind of scan a huge swathe of water and find them. So that's how they have established that some certain areas, especially in the Persian Gulf, some oil tankers that are allegedly heading towards Iran at some point turn these transponders off and they go off on the AIS system. But then when you use satellites, you can find and see them where they are.
So are we talking countries that are doing this or oil companies that are doing this?
Could be both. For example, it could be a Chinese refinery that is sending its tanker to lift Iranian crude from the Persian Gulf, from Iranian ports. But this is obviously illegal based on international laws because you need to see the location of these seas for search and rescue reasons, to avoid collisions.
Presumably, it's not in the interest of these entities to just turn their transponders off if it's illegal. Just remind us why they're doing this, what they're trying to avoid.
So the U.S. Administration has introduced sanctions against purchase of Iranian crude, and those are so-called secondary sanctions. So they are applied also to non-U.S. companies. Say, for example, if a refinery in southern Greece, if they buy Iranian crude, then the U.S. will tell the Greek refinery that they cannot do business in the United States or with U.S. companies. And in many cases for these refineries or for these oil companies, it's no-brainer. A market the size of the United States is far more attractive to them than Iran. But there are some companies that are state-owned, like in China, that still need the Iranian crude and also have the support of the Chinese government to bypass these sanctions and have allegedly continued buying Iranian crude in defiance of U.S.'s unilateral oil sanctions against Iran.
So getting blocked out of the U.S. market is the punishment for evading those U.S. sanctions on Iran.
Theoretically, and the reason I say theoretically, that for a long time, the U.S. administration turned a blind eye, especially in case of some Chinese big oil companies. For some time, they actually did give these companies an official waiver from the sanctions. But just recently, the U.S. administration said that it will bring the export of Iranian crude to zero in order to put so-called maximum pressure on Iranian government to bring the Iranians to a negotiation table in order to renegotiate a new nuclear deal that President Trump wants. So the U.S. administration has now said that they will implement these sanctions fully. Nevertheless, the information from the market shows that Iran has managed to export something around 350,000 barrels of oil per day. But that is a very, very sharp decline to the amount it was exporting a year ago, which was 2.5 million barrels a day. So we have witnessed a very, very sharp decline. Nevertheless, they are not zero yet.
Amir Paivar, an independent analyst, speaking with us from London. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Coming up, a social media trend in Indonesia, where young people are encouraged to skip dating and head straight to marriage. That's up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Indonesia, Gen Z kids are like Gen Z kids all over the globe, anxious about the future, addicted to their phones, loving their memes. But some young adults in Indonesia are also into an online movement that's so conservative, even their grandparents might find it extreme. It's a social media campaign that advocates no dating, ever. Here's The World's Patrick Nguyen.
There's a young woman in a flowing hijab and black robe. You can just see her face and hands. And she's standing in front of a crowd of people, many of them teenage girls. She's got a phone to her ear, calling her boyfriend. Everyone is super tense. Some dude just got dumped. Bad day for that guy, but for the 800 people in the room and thousands more watching on YouTube, it's cause for joy. They are all followers of Indonesia Tanpa Pacaran, Indonesia Without Dating, a movement that is exactly what it sounds like. And it's very popular. Millions of followers, driven by Instagram accounts with short videos and memes about how dating is this sinister Western idea that will ruin your life.
It's pretty much about domesticating women.
That's Professor Dina Afrianti from La Trobe University in Australia. She studies gender and Islam in Indonesia. And she says the memes tell women that their role is to
cook, be good to their husband, and serve your husband well in bed. And then you will have a good life. Which is like, that's ridiculous.
If the job of young people is to confuse and shock adults, then mission accomplished. Liberal-minded Indonesians who came of age in the late 90s, when the country went from dictatorship to democracy, they see this stuff and think, really? This is what's cool now? Here's Devi Asmarani, founder of a feminist online magazine in Indonesia called Magdalene.
I really would never have thought 20 years ago when we're just going through democratization process, I would have never thought that we would become this kind of society.
The thing is, no one is forcing these kids to swear off dating and be chaste. And they're really chaste. To them, even 1950s American dating standards would be deviant. They're pushing for the norms of, say, Saudi Arabia. No face-to-face contact with your potential spouse, not without family in the room. And get married young. That's the message, pushed through memes and cute videos like this one on Instagram. You see a woman with striking eyes. It's her wedding day. She's totally veiled in a brilliant white abaya studded with pearls. And then later, she's making curry for her husband, who watches with adoration. So that's what the anti-dating subculture is like. But Indonesia Tanpa Pacaran is also like a club. You can join these online chat groups offering advice on finding a spouse for a fee. You can also pay to attend big seminars where you'll see imams leading young women to take vows to never, ever date boys. Then the real fun begins. There are these social media influencers who come on stage. The most famous is Nata Reza, handsome with a perfect swoosh of black hair. He walks out and that's like 1,000 hijabi girls sitting on the floor of a mosque going nuts. Magdalene, the feminist magazine, they actually sent a journalist to one of these events.
It's more like a concert.
A boy band.
A boy band concert.
That's reporter Elma Adisia on the line with her editor, Devi.
The girls start to
squeal.
And it's like a fangirling.
Like fangirling. But what are they fangirling over? Well, Nata, his backstory is that one day he sees this young woman on Instagram. Total stranger. He likes one of her photos. They start messaging. Then, after just 3 hours of chatting, boom, he proposes. They get hitched, and now their life is apparently bliss. Their Instagram accounts, 2 million followers combined, they're just videos of their excruciating cuteness set to cheesy music. Here, they're at a restaurant, and she gently lifts her veil so he can feed her little bites of toast. There's lots of product placement, too. Keep scrolling, she's promoting beauty products. Keep scrolling, he's promoting junk food. Keep scrolling, and
poligami itu nggak salah-salah. Poligami butuh ilmu, poligami butuh keadilan.
All of a sudden, they're defending the holiness of polygamy. That is really not common in Indonesia. But this subculture, it's part of a greater push among conservatives to make so-called moderate Muslim Indonesia into a more orthodox place. And it's kind of working. These kids are super orthodox. Professor Afrianti says the message to young women is,
why make your life so difficult? Why you have to work so hard to get a job? You can become someone's second, third, or fourth wife. Easy.
This feels like a step backward to a lot of Indonesians. But is the appeal of these memes that mysterious? Maybe not. Dating, for a lot of people, is scary. Finding a job in this economy? Scary. This movement is selling an express lane to fairy tale bliss. And I do mean selling. Joining the anti-dating chat groups, it costs $12. And Afrianti says tapping into all that lovelorn angst can be very lucrative.
You can imagine if they have now about 600,000 members, you can count how big the business is.
To fit in at the seminars, you can buy the official No Dating tote bag. For guys, there are t-shirts for $10. And for the ladies, a long veil with the official logo. That'll be $7. Or if you're short on cash, you can always go to YouTube to watch the new music video, Dream Lover, which dramatizes the day that Nata and his amazing hair proposed to his wife online. Nearly 7 million views and counting. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
A note now, as we shift gears rapidly, on the opening of the European Parliament's new session today in Strasbourg in France.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the European Parliament.
The Chamber's president, Antonio Tajani, barely had time to get the session going before the political fracture lines were on full display. All 751 EU parliamentarians stood as they got ready to hear the EU anthem, Beethoven's Ode to Joy, except the 29 members of the Brexit Party. They stayed seated to protest against the UK still being part of the EU, which prompted this rebuke from Tajani.
Alzarsi in piedi è una questione di rispetto, non è.
Rising to your feet is a matter of respect, Tajani told them.
Anche quando si ascolta l'inno di un altro paese, ci si alza in piedi.
Even when you listen to the anthem of another country, you rise to your feet. And the chamber applauded. Later, the Brexit Party members did stand, but as the anthem played, they turned their backs on the room. Just a taste of the tensions this new session of the European Parliament will have to navigate, at least until Britain does leave the EU, or should I say, if. Some ultra-Orthodox Jews say the coverage of the measles outbreak in New York has anti-Semitic overtones. This Orthodox nurse sees it differently.
I wouldn't ever condone name-calling or anti-Semitic behavior, but when the media is focusing on the outbreak in the Orthodox Jewish communities, it's because there is an outbreak in the Orthodox Jewish communities.
I'm Marco Werman. That's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a production of WGBH, the BBC World Service, and PRI PRX. A Russian submarine is back in port today after a fire killed 14 sailors on board. Russian news reports describe the vessel as a nuclear-powered mini-submarine. The sub is now in Severomorsk, the far northern base of Russia's North Fleet. Tons of questions are swirling. President Putin held an emergency meeting with his defense minister today and ordered him to personally investigate the accident. The BBC's Olga Ivshina told me Russian officials are not saying much so far.
Well, they said that there was a fire on board of the vessel and it was now brought back to the base and 14 people are dead, a few more are in the hospital. And President Putin has summoned defense minister and spoke to him. And tomorrow, defense minister is going to Severomorsk to look into details and consequences of what happened.
Has the government said anything about the cause of the fire?
No, you see, there are no confirmed reports about what type of vessel it is, but a few respected Russian media outlets say it's Lasharik. And if it's true, that's a mini submarine with a nuclear engine. It's top secret vessel. And that's why, you know, if something happened on board, it's really huge. And of course, minimum information would be released.
It would be a huge event. Why? Because it's a nuclear sub?
Due to a number of reasons. First of all, you know, many people now draw parallels with the year 2000. Back then, Russian nuclear submarine sank. It was called Kursk. And back then, many people criticized Vladimir Putin for the way he dealt with the tragedy. You know, he was very reserved and, you know, information wasn't released properly and they refused to get some help. This time, he's trying his best, it seems, to deal with it properly. But still, there are many, many questions. You know, I was reading local forums and chats in Severomorsk and some people are scared because there might have been some nuclear contamination. But just tiny, tiny drops of information are getting out and getting in. That's why people ask more and more questions.
This is a nuclear submarine. A Russian government says it was taking measurements, studying the seafloor. No more details than that. Is the secrecy around kind of all that?
Yeah, of course, there is a lot of secrecy to begin with the Severomorsk itself. So this naval base is a closed town. It's really hard to get in. It's even hard to get out. You know, many people in the city have signed no disclosure agreements. It's really hard to get anything off it. And we're already getting, you know, sort of off the record writing on the forums saying, you know, security services are everywhere. They're controlling the flow of information. Just a tiny detail, you know, this incident was first reported by a local online newspaper. But then the journalist received calls from really high-ranking officials who told him to delete the story. And only after that, in a few hours, Ministry of Defense published its version of the events.
I've seen analysts today, Russia analysts, say that an event like this does no favors to Putin's popularity. What is he worried about?
Well, you see, situation in Russia at the moment is quite hard. You know, there is an economic crisis and people are struggling. And of course, you know, they're asking more and more questions to Putin. And I think the incident itself is not a huge harm because incidents do happen. But it's crucial how is he going to deal with it, because everyone remembers Kursk tragedy and everyone remembers how badly it was dealt with. Because in Severomorsk, it's a very personal tragedy to most of the people in that town, because everyone there is somehow connected to the Navy. And, you know, last time this tragedy hit people personally there, we'll see what happens this time. But people are demanding more information and not getting it yet.
Yeah, well, Vladimir Putin canceled all his plans today to manage this disaster and to meet with his defense minister. What do you think Russians are hoping to hear from him that would give them some confidence?
Russians want truth. They want to know what happened, why. At the moment, we just know that these were one of the best specialists in Russian Navy. There were, you know, two heroes of Russia aboard. So it was really, really a highly skilled crew. So why did they risk their lives and what caused their deaths?
How likely are we to get full details of what happened?
We'll almost never get full details of what have happened due to the fact that these are top secret military missions. Hopefully we'll get more information why it happened, you know, who died, under which circumstances. But full report, I think, will never be available.
Olga Ivshina with the BBC's Russian service. Thanks for sharing with us what you know.
My pleasure.
Around the world, we're seeing mistrust in public health. Just ahead, we'll see how this looks with measles here in one U.S. community. But first, the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The health ministry there says more than 1,400 people have died since the outbreak started last year. This is far fewer than the West African outbreak 5 years ago, but it could get much worse. Lori Garrett has been following Ebola in Africa for decades, and she says that unrest in Congo makes Ebola an even bigger threat. You've been through three Ebola outbreaks. One of them happened in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1995. On this latest outbreak in DRC, you're tracking the numbers. What are you seeing here that distinguishes this outbreak from others you've witnessed in the past?
This outbreak is the first one to take place in a setting of profound violence, with long-term warfare, deep distrust of the government, deep distrust of foreigners. And we're losing this battle not because of the virus, but because of the environment politically in which the virus is spreading.
And practically, what does that mean for the ability to address the disease?
Several things. First of all, you can't freely move about unless you're prepared to pay ransom money to armed groups as you approach a bridge or enter a village. There have been a number of healthcare workers, two assassinated and several more shot in the line of work or threatened and attacked in their homes. More than 180 assaults have occurred on Ebola treatment centers, diagnostic centers, and clinics. And I think there's a second aspect to this, which is the level of distrust is so high, coupled with quite justified distrust of the Kinshasa DRC government, 1,500 miles away, with a long history of corruption, that it is fueling a kind of overdrive on the sorts of rumors that always swirl around epidemics. And it doesn't matter whether you're in Africa or you're in New York City, there are always rumors, falsehoods, out-and-out lies, and conspiracy theories that go around outbreaks and around public health campaigns. Just look at what we're dealing with here in this country with measles and parents that have reached the conclusion that measles vaccines will somehow sicken their children. Well, now compound that by many orders of magnitude, where you have violent organizations that have absolutely destroyed any sense of trust in communities. And now the rumors start spreading. Oh, the foreigners brought it. Oh, they brought it so they can steal their body organs and sell them in Europe. Oh, they brought it from outer space. Oh, it's connected with the conspiracy of Kabila stealing the election and installing his corrupt crony as the new president of Congo in an election in which our districts were forbidden and were disenfranchised and not allowed to vote. So you start to see these rumors building one upon another.
This is not your average outbreak. I mean, you're describing like some major problems here, including the mistrust, political dysfunction, violence that has prompted a lot of NGOs to pull out of DRC. I mean, it sounds like what's needed is a multinational, multi-pronged effort to deal with this. Is that happening in any form as far as you can see?
Well, the good news is we have a lot of now very skilled, very smart, well-trained African disease responders. For the first time, there's now an African Center for Disease Control modeled after the American CDC. And there are many Africans who were involved in the huge epidemic in West Africa that went from 2014 to 2016 and gained tremendous skills on everything from how to trace down cases, how to safely bury bodies. So we have a really strong pan-African response.
So that's the good news.
That's the good news. And the other good news is, you know, we have a vaccine that works. And more than 115,000 people have been vaccinated. The bad news is that that's just not enough. First of all, why only 115,000 vaccinated? Because it's so dangerous to get out into the villages and vaccinate. Secondly, it's underfunded. The kind of scale of global response with billions of dollars, that is not happening.
If you were advising the players here on a solution for DR Congo's Ebola outbreak, what would you tell them?
I would tell them that they need to bring in some serious diplomatic power. They need power that is far beyond the expertise of people trained in public health. Public health people are brilliant at what they do, but they don't know how to negotiate between armed forces.
Laurie Garrett, the author of The Coming Plague, really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you.
The U.S. is dealing with its own disease outbreak, one that also has roots in mistrust. We're talking about measles now. 28 states have confirmed cases of measles so far this year. One of the biggest outbreaks is in New York State, in particular two communities, Brooklyn and Rockland County. Most of the people affected in those outbreaks are ultra-Orthodox Jews. Fermet Goldberger recently spoke with a nurse who's on the front line of this outbreak.
My name is Blima Marcus. I'm a nurse practitioner in Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center.
She also teaches nursing at Hunter College in New York, and she jokes that she's taken on another job.
My new role, apparently, is vaccine nurse or measles nurse, depending on your preference.
Marcus is part of a group of healthcare workers who have come together to provide evidence-based vaccine education for the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community. Her community. She's also an Orthodox Jew.
I'm primarily doing what I'm doing because I noticed a one-way direction of information reaching the Orthodox community, one-way direction of misinformation.
Much of that misinformation comes in the form of pamphlets and phone hotlines that promote vaccine skepticism. Because this is an insular community where many people don't read secular newspapers or go online for information.
I do think that this community and other insular minority communities share certain traits that make them more vulnerable to misinformation. And there has been evidence that the larger secular mainstream anti-vax initiative preys on these minority communities where they know they can grab a foothold. And this has happened in Minnesota in Somali communities.
That was in 2017 when Minnesota experienced its largest measles outbreak in nearly 30 years.
And it certainly is happening here in the Frum community.
In New York, anti-vaccination groups have put their focus on the ultra Orthodox communities. And they've held events like this one in April.
So every lab and white coat walking into offices here and saying that vaccines are safe and effective are lying because they've never done the studies.
Blima Marcus wants people in the ultra-Orthodox community to understand that the MMR vaccine is safe and effective in preventing measles, mumps, and rubella. But she also wants people outside the community to know that the vast majority of Orthodox Jews do vaccinate their children.
We want to try and get to everyone, so we're going to keep our questions to like about 30 seconds and our answers to 5 minutes if we can. I'm sorry.
On a recent evening, Marcus and other healthcare professionals came out to answer questions and provide information for a group of about 200 women in Muncie. It's the ultra-Orthodox hub of Rockland County, New York. And as of June 19, there were 275 confirmed cases of measles in the county.
It's a distinct honor to have with us this evening Rabbi Shabbos Shlita, Marid Asra of Kahal, Knesset Yisrael.
The panel included rabbis, pediatricians, and epidemiologists and nurse practitioners, all Orthodox Jews. They spoke of a Jewish obligation to take necessary health precautions. They shared stories of how the outbreak has affected their patients and why vaccines are safe and effective in eradicating these diseases. And Blima Marcus says they've been inundated with emails and calls from worried parents.
I spent 47 minutes on the phone with a father on Friday answering his questions. He had 6 children, vaccinated the first 5.
Many of the women who came to the workshop say they don't need convincing. They already vaccinate their kids, and they're here to show solidarity.
When someone's child is diagnosed in our community, we're all there for them. The whole shul, the whole community, everybody gets together. What can we do for them? All we have to do is immunize. That's all.
Thank you.
And many say they're frustrated by the way their Jewish community has been portrayed. But beyond that, there is an underlying sense that fears about the outbreaks are feeding into anti-Semitic stereotypes. It's especially sensitive for Hasidic Jews, many of whom are descendant from Holocaust survivors.
I understand why some people would say, well, they're singling us out and it's anti-Semitic.
But Blima Marcus says that's not how she sees it.
I wouldn't ever condone name-calling or anti-Semitic behavior. But when the media is focusing on the outbreak in the Orthodox Jewish communities, it's because there is an outbreak in the Orthodox Jewish communities. And that's just simply the facts.
I did speak with one Orthodox woman at the meeting who told me she did not vaccinate her kids, and all 3 of them came down with the measles this year. She wouldn't tell me her name, and she wouldn't speak on tape. But when I saw her later after the meeting, she told me the speakers were appealing to emotions and not presenting enough evidence. She wasn't convinced. For The World, from Ed Goldberger in Muncie, New York.
An astronomical treat today for Chile and Argentina, a rare total solar eclipse. That's when the moon passes directly in front of the sun, casting a shadow on Earth that blocks the sunlight. Thousands of people, including eclipse-seeking tourists, planted themselves on the perfect spot along the eclipse's arc to gawk at the sky. David Barron is among them. He's in La Serena, Chile. David's a journalist and the author of American Eclipse.
It's an otherworldly experience. And I mean that quite literally, because it feels like you're on a different planet, because you're looking at this sky you've never seen. In the middle of the day, it goes dark. Overhead, you can see planets and a few stars. On the horizon, you're ringed by basically a 360-degree sunset, because all around you in the distance, it's still daylight while it's dark where you are. So on the horizon, all around you, it's sort of an orange glow. And what you can see is the sun's outer atmosphere called the solar corona. And it's just the most dazzling, magical thing you've ever seen. Pictures really don't do it justice. It shimmers with this weird light, and it's got this texture to it. It looks sort of like strands of cotton or silk. And also, we'll have the opportunity to see 3 planets flanking the sun today. Venus will be on the horizon. Mars and Mercury will be up to the right. Wow. And that's one of the things that I find so amazing is, during a total eclipse, you basically have this visceral sense of what the solar system is, because it's the only time that you can actually see the planets on either side of the sun, and you really understand that we're floating in space.
What is the mood around you there in La Serena? Is it kind of a cultural phenomenon?
Oh, absolutely. Landing at the airport, there are banners up everywhere. There are billboards on the highways. People are selling eclipse glasses everywhere. I was at the supermarket the other day. There was a big countdown clock. I mean, everyone is excited about it.
A lot of tourists?
Many, many tourists, a lot of Americans. The eclipse of 2017 created new eclipse chasers. So I was just speaking the other night to a group of Yale alumni, and about half of them had seen the 2017 eclipse, and that prompted them to want to come see another. And about the other half hadn't seen it, and that prompted them to want to come see one.
For an eclipse pro like you, David, what makes the experience of viewing one eclipse different from another?
This will be my seventh total solar eclipse.
Number seven.
And right. And people will often ask, well, once you've seen one, why do you need to see another? But they're different every time. Each one is special in its own way. First, there's the setting. I've seen some on a beach, some on mountaintops. A lot of it, too, is who you're with. You know, I've watched eclipses in major cities with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, which is a great experience. I've watched some pretty much by myself. As long as there are no clouds, I don't think there's any such thing as a bad total eclipse.
What happens after an eclipse? Like, what do people do?
Most people who have seen a total solar eclipse describe it as indescribable. At that moment, when it suddenly goes dark in the middle of the day and it is safe to look at the sun, people take off their eclipse glasses and they just fall apart. They start screaming. They start crying. It's a very, very emotional experience. After the total phase, you still have another hour and a quarter of partial phase to watch. But no one cares because it's just so overwhelming. And then it's over. And, you know, it's time to get back to your normal life or start planning for the next eclipse. And Chile is extraordinarily lucky, because total eclipses only occur somewhere on Earth about once every 18 months, and they're usually scattered all over the place. But the next total solar eclipse to occur will be December of next year, also in Chile.
You going to go back for that one?
Planning on it, absolutely.
David Barron is a journalist and the author of American Eclipse. He's been speaking with us from La Serena, Chile. As always, for Eclipse Watchers, here's to clear skies. David Barron, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
They say don't stare at an eclipse, so we have pictures for you. They're at theworld.org. Finally today, we head to Portugal for a sampling of the current music scene there. If you're anticipating the melancholy of Fado, Portuguese DJ and hip-hop producer Holly wants you to think again.
The music scene in Portugal is great. It's full of different sounds, different textures, different languages, different cultures. Definitely the biggest music style right now in Portugal is the Portuguese rap. And since we don't speak that much English in the country, we just made our own hip-hop. And we just like mix hip-hop and rap with the Portuguese language. This song is called Encontrar, which is a song that I made with my friend Sojay for my last EP called Avenal 2500. Avenal 2500 means it's the name of the neighborhood where I come from in my hometown called Caldas da Rainha. This song is very important for me because it's a record that talks about a lot of feelings that I've been through with my life and with my artistic life. Encontrar means never find. You always want to achieve like the next step, the next level, the next goal. Sometimes like you set up a bunch of goals and then like once you reach them, you always think like, oh, once I reach them, I'm going to be happy. I'm just going to be okay with where I am. And once you achieve them, you always feel that you want more and you always want to go to the next one and just keep growing up. Everyone knows about Portugal. Everyone knows that like Portugal was like one of the main countries in the 1500s, and that we found like America and Brazil and a bunch of other places in Asia. So I think like the rap is just like becoming bigger, and people are just gonna just listen more to the Portuguese rap.
Sozinho no meu pai.
That was DJ and hip-hop producer Holly on the music scene in Portugal. Holly's new EP is Avenal 2500. As he told us, it's the address of his childhood home in Lisbon. We close out the show with another big artist on the Portuguese music scene, the group Wet Bed Gang, and their new tune, Bairro. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Our theme music was composed by Ned Porter. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.